Hello again, everybody. This is Larry Bonchek, and I have a really distinct pleasure today of introducing to you Paul Kettle, who is a psychiatrist at Lancaster General Hospital, but whose background is quite elaborate and noteworthy. Following his residency training in psychiatry at Johns Hopkins and the Institute of Psychiatry in London, Dr. Kettle worked in the Indian Health Service in Alaska for 2 years, but since 1986, he's been on the faculty at Penn State in Hershey. There, he served in a number of roles, including chairman of the department for 5 years, residency training director, and the founder of the Geriatric Psychiatry Unit and Geriatric Psychiatry Fellowship Program. Currently, in addition to his teaching and research at Penn State, he does his clinical work at Lancaster General Hospital 4 days a week and spends 1 day a week in Hershey. Paul is board certified in psychiatry, of course, and he also holds subspecialty boards in geriatric psychiatry and addiction psychiatry. He completed the Master's in Health Administration program at Penn State. In 1998, he was named to the Joyce Kales Endowed Chair in Community Psychiatry at Penn State. He's most proud, he tells me, of the teaching awards bestowed on him by 12 separate medical school classes. Paul, welcome to our microphone.
Thank you, and thank you for the invitation.
Well, we're going to talk today about depression. I would think this is a topic that will interest almost all of our listeners, because it's hard to think of anyone who hasn't been touched by depression in one way or another, and I don't mean necessarily personally, but doesn't have someone either in their family or in their close circle of friends who has been affected by depression. And one gets the impression that depression is clearly becoming more prevalent. Is that true? And if so, why?
Well, it is true, and why is not totally clear. What's very clear is that since World War II, there's been an increase in prevalence in depression, and that increase continues. Surveys in the 1980s, for example, showed that about 3 to 4% of the U.S. population was suffering from major depression at any one time. In 2002, the estimate was about 7 or 8%. So it continues to increase. The reason why is not at all clear. People wonder about the change in the structure of the American family. People wonder about, for example, the growth of television and time that people spend away from each other with machines rather than with people. And these are all things that people wonder about, but for whatever reason, there really is a increase in depression. And so practitioners who think it's happening more are absolutely correct.
The way you phrased it, that people, the number of people that are suffering from depression at any one time, leads to the question of the nature of depression and how it afflicts people, because people do go in and come out of depression. So what is the natural history of depression, and what are the different types of depression, and how do they affect people?
Right. The type of depression that most people think of, at least most doctors think of, is what's called major depression, meaning a depression that would be treated with medication, for example. And that type of depression has physical symptoms. In other words, a physical solution would have physical symptoms. Typically, the syndrome would come on subacutely, and by that I mean over a period of weeks, people would begin not feeling as well, that their sleep would not be as good, they wouldn't eat as well, their energy level would be less, and in addition to that, they would have psychological symptoms of feeling worse and feeling worse about themselves, and even thoughts about death or suicide. Typically, that happens over a period of weeks, and untreated, typically depression goes on for about 6 to 9 months, although it can last longer than that. And so it's a subacute onset, chronic course over months, and it recurs most of the time at some point in someone's life.
What is the usual age of onset, or is there a usual age?
Well, depression can occur at any point in somebody's life, but the most common time it comes on is actually in the 20s, and it can come on from any time. It's really quite rare before puberty, but can occur in teens. The most common time is in the 20s, but it can occur at any point during the lifespan.
Now, the way that you talked about the increasing frequency, the cyclical nature of the disease, and we talked about the causality. That leads me to ask you whether or not environmental factors, chemical factors, could be related, because after all, we now treat it as if it's a chemical imbalance.
Right. We don't have a good answer of what the cause is. Could environmental factors play a role? I think the answer is yes. I think most people would say that genetics are the most important, that if it runs in your family, you're more likely to get it. But just like other disorders, heart disease, for example, where there's also clear behavioral components in the etiology of the disease, depression also has clear genetic causes, but also behavioral causes. We know, for example, that if a child is separated from their mother at an early age, if the mother dies, they're much more likely to have depression. And other types of stressors are important. So people wonder, for example, if the breakup of families may lead people to be more vulnerable, especially those people who may have a genetic influence in already present in their family.
That's very interesting to me, because I know there's a flip side to that coin also. Loss of a parent in childhood can also be a spur to greater accomplishment. In fact, my wife, who's a psychologist, wrote her doctoral dissertation on that very subject. So they're two sides of the same coin.
Right. I think that it's a scar, and you know, people can grow around the scar and be stronger, but unfortunately that's not true for everybody, that some folks find it difficult to take part in relationships, and that can be a problem.
We're talking about children and adolescence and depression. How common is depression in childhood, aside from this single etiology that we've talked about?
Right. And that's a very good question, and we don't have good data. What I can tell you is that before puberty, that is in young children, it is uncommon. That is not common at all. That's not to say it doesn't occur, but it's not common. Following puberty, it occurs at an increasing rate to the 20s. What happens is throughout adolescence, it continues to increase in prevalence, reaching adult rates. The problem of trying to find out is that adolescence is a time of turmoil, that there are no adolescents, for example, who are happy all the time. The question is, what is dysphoria in an adolescent that's understandable due to personal doubts or relationship problems that fly by? And what is a depressive illness? And those are questions that are very, very difficult to answer. I guess what I can say is that depression, meaning the symptom, is extraordinarily common in adolescents. However, depression, the syndrome, or major depression, we think is less common than in adults, but gradually increases in prevalence as one gets older.
And I guess to get the real numbers, you'd have to follow a whole bunch of adolescents who manifest some depression or depressive thoughts at times and see how many of them cycle in and out repeatedly as life goes on.
Sure. Although what we can say is that it is increasing, that the increase in depression is seen in all age groups, but it's especially prominent in younger people, that younger people seem to be affected more, and on college campuses it's viewed as being an epidemic, for example. Unfortunately, the amount of young people who come into college health centers with depression has been growing, seems to be occurring at astonishing rates.
Well, and I know that suicide is not any longer uncommon on college campuses.
Right. What happened actually from about 1950 to about 1980 is that suicide rates tripled among young people age 15 to 24. And what the story was is that the rates stopped being childlike rates and started being adult-like rates. And so young people in college now commit suicide at the rate the same as general adults, unfortunately. And so that is, of course, a terrible consequence of the disease. And one question should be, why should I worry about depression? And the answer is, it's often a fatal illness. That is, about 1.5% of Americans kill themselves. And so it's really an astonishing number that about 1 in 70 people will end their own lives, and so it can be a fatal illness.
Now, since we're talking about age groups, let's go to the other end of the spectrum and talk about the elderly, where depression, again, is more common, is it not?
Yeah, depression often occurs in elders. And first of all, it's not clear it occurs more commonly in elders than in younger people. It's just that it seems to be more severe. And by that I mean the age group that's most likely to kill themselves are elders. Those over the age of 65, especially elder men, are more likely to kill themselves. And the other thing is that we think that chronic illnesses of any kind are more likely to cause depression. So elders who unfortunately have chronic illnesses of many types often have depression that occur after they have heart disease or a stroke or Parkinson's or any kind of brain injury. And what happens unfortunately is that depression, when it occurs in that age group, not only affects them in the usual symptoms, but also affects their ability to manage those illnesses, and we think even makes those illnesses worse. In fact, they're more likely to die. That elders with depression are more likely to die than elders without depression with the same chronic illness.
Well, I don't want to make light of this. I'm only going to use a humorous line to make a point, but that is, there's that well-known axiom that even paranoids have enemies. And similarly, I mean, the elderly very often have good reason to be depressed. They've lost a spouse. They have, as you mentioned, a chronic illness. So it is likely to be a situational depression, at least at the onset.
Right, and that's a very good point, that what can be a situational or understandable depression at the onset doesn't mean that it's not a serious problem. It doesn't mean it won't turn into a major depression. For example, we know in grief, for example, which unfortunately occurs more commonly in women because men wear out sooner, many women do well, but we think about 20% of women go on to develop a major depression following the loss of their spouse, meaning that the people who tend to do well, but the people who don't, don't. And that chronic stress is, we think, responsible for causing a major depression. Specifically, what the theory is for any type of chronic stress or chronic illness is that the chronic stress would increase cortisol, which of course makes sense as a stress response to any kind of situation. And increased cortisol then makes changes in the brain, specifically in the hippocampus. We think that it shrinks the hippocampus. And then vegetative signs occur. Vegetative signs mean problems with your appetite or sleep or the regulation of those things, which then turn into a major depression. So any type of chronic stress, be grief or a chronic illness, can literally drag somebody down into major depression and can cause all the physical signs associated with it.
And is that can that occur while the cortisol levels are still high, or it's because they eventually have to drop?
Well, what we think is that they're chronically high. And for example, in heart disease, folks with depression are more likely to die. Those with depression continue to have high cortisol levels, continue to have high stress responses, which may well wear out the autonomic nervous system, which makes it more likely to die, that they're not as able to respond to arrhythmias or other kinds of acute assaults.
Since we're talking about stress and hormone levels, I'd like to ask you about postpartum depression, because that strikes me as a situation where hormone levels do drop. Perhaps you could just clarify what we think we know about that particular entity.
Right. First of all, depression occurs in women after childbirth, but it should be remembered that depression can occur during pregnancy or any other time as well. It is slightly increased after childbirth, and it is thought that the hormonal changes that occur with childbirth are the cause. But depression in women itself is a common problem, that we think depression occurs in women twice as often as in men. And that has been made clear by a variety of randomized studies of the general population. So depression in women occurs, unfortunately, more often. It is thought that hormonal changes or hormonal differences in women may be a cause. We know that the increase in depression in women occurs after puberty, and that difference narrows at menopause. So clearly hormones are important. But in addition to that, unfortunately, women are different than men in a wide array of reasons. And one of them is that women are more likely to be abused. And that chronic stress also, we think, is another reason why depression occurs more commonly in women. So it's a complicated factor. Again, there's probably biologic reasons, meaning that there are hormonal differences that may put women more at risk, but also social and interpersonal reasons, including, unfortunately, high rates of abuse.
So the postpartum depression, you mean, is occurring in part because there is already a predisposition, if you will, or a substrate that's more conducive to developing depression?
In some women, and in some women, postpartum depression simply occurs because of the hormonal shifts. In other words, let's say if you need 5 points to get a depression, and you get 2 points from genetics, and you get 2 points from hormones, it doesn't take much to throw you over. And some women, of course, who may be more susceptible may get all 5 points from hormones. Mm-hmm. And there may be some women who get 4 points from genetics and it doesn't take much to throw them over. But likewise, if you have a past history of abuse, current relationship problems, and have some genetic influence in your past, that can all come together to the perfect storm, as it were, to cause depression. So it's clear that hormonal differences are important in women to cause depression postpartum or at other times, but there's also other factors and it all comes together. Much like in heart disease, all of the risk factors are additive, and any one may outshine the others in some individual, but they all come together, unfortunately, to cause the disease in the end.
Well, I hadn't specifically asked you to list the different types of depression, but we seem to be touching a lot of bases as we go along. One of the bases that we obviously need to touch very heavily is bipolar disorder. I wonder if you would bring that into the discussion by saying some things about the incidence of bipolar disorder and what fraction of depression constitutes bipolar disorder, and maybe define it a little bit for some of our listeners.
Sure, and bipolar disorder has gotten a lot of attention of late, probably because there are more medications available to treat it, and so we all hear the marketing. And bipolar disorder is a disease where people have both episodes of low mood as well as episodes of high mood. And by high mood, I mean either that people can feel euphoric or irritable, and they also have decreased sleep, increased energy level. It's one of the only things I can think of that cause decreased sleep and increased energy. And so that's a good screening question. The time that they spend in mania is not as long as in depression. The time that people spend in mania is typically a week or weeks, whereas the time for depression is typically months. And so if you look at somebody with true bipolar disorder, the amount of time they spend in manic episodes is small compared to the time they spend in depressive episodes. So typically, an episode of mania will come on either just before someone goes into depression or just after somebody comes out of a depression, and they will spend a time of increased mood, decreased sleep, increased energy, lots of plans, thought racing, and oftentimes behaviors that get them into trouble, either spending money that they don't have or sexually acting out or some combination of all of that. And then typically there would be a period of normal mood, and then they will slide into a period of abnormal mood, often the same time of the year that they got into trouble to begin with. Bipolar disorder, we know, occurs less commonly than major depression. Bipolar 1 or true manic depressive illness, we think, occurs in about 1% of the population. Bipolar 2, where people have little blips of mania after or before depression, occurs in 2 or 3% of the population. So when you compare that to 7% of the people who have depression at any one time, or maybe 20% of the people of the population who will get it at some point in their life, it's less common, but certainly something common enough that any practitioner will see it in any given week. They'll see a few folks with bipolar disorder.
The one thing we haven't talked about is, what do we know now about the common threads that run through these different types of depression? Let's talk about now at the cellular and biochemical level, because that's really where we have to get to.
Right, and the hope was that genetics would give us the answer, that we would find a gene or a couple of genes. We could find out what the gene did and we would know. And in fact, many of the studies were done with the Amish. Janice Eglin and other folks from the University of Miami studied the Amish and looked at affective disorders in that population, where there was relatively less substance abuse and relatively less other stressors, and the hope would be that you could find a gene. And unfortunately,
excuse me for interrupting, but the Amish do have a substantial incidence of depression, do they?
Right. Not? Depression and bipolar disorder.
Despite this, the lack of
lifestyle.
These, yes, and right. Okay.
Which again speaks to the genetics, how important it is.
Exactly.
So that population was viewed not only because of that, but it was also clear what the family history was. You could talk to somebody's relatives and their uncle. They were just down the road.
Well, not only that, but I mean, if you're looking for a genetic mechanism, the Amish are obviously a fertile field to plow. No pun intended.
Right.
Holmes Morton, in the Clinic for Special Children was actually interviewed by me on our very first CD. He's made a life study of genetic disorders, so I can understand then that they would be likely to have a lot of depression if it is heavily influenced by genetics.
Right, and I don't know that the rates are higher, but certainly the genetics are clearer. But even in that population, it was not possible to find a clear gene. So first of all, there probably are a bunch of genes that come together. And I suppose in retrospect, it would be probably too easy to think that any disorder that occurs in that great a number of the population, that there would be a gene. But in any event, that was the hope, but those hopes were dashed. So the question then came, well, what is happening chemically? And we were all taught in medical school that what happens chemically is that serotonin and norepinephrine is decreased in these folks, leading to decreased sleep, decreased energy, decreased appetite, as well as decreased mood. And that's true, but then the question is, well, what causes a decreased norepinephrine and a decreased serotonin? And these days, attention is being directed more to the structure of the brain, and with modern functional MRI studies or PET scans, there is increasing evidence that in depression, there is decreased activity in the frontal lobe, and also that the hippocampus shrinks with depression, shrinks up to 20% in size. So what I guess the answer is, the more you know, the more you don't know, or at least the more you know about what you don't know. And so while it's clear that genetics are important, and while it's clear that brain chemistry is important, and while it's clear that stressors that happen in your life are important, in any individual, any one of these can trump the others and cause it. And so, unfortunately, we don't have a clear reason, or we don't have a clear path to follow if we wanted to prevent depression in the people we love. There's no clear thing that we can tell them to do. Clear things would be things your mother told you to do, that is, live right, exercise well, be nice to the people who are nice to you, and avoid substances of abuse. Unfortunately, we haven't advanced much beyond what our mothers told us, which continues to be good advice, by the way.
Now, let's be sure we've covered the different types of depression. I mean, we talked about bipolar, we talked in childhood and adolescence, we talked about the elderly, talked about postpartum.
Right.
Are there other major types of depression?
Right, there are other types of depression. One is what's called adjustment disorder, and this is something that primary care docs see every day, all day in their practice. And this is when something bad happens to somebody, they feel bad in response. And a typical grief reaction would happen, or relationship problems, or grieving the loss of your health with a chronic illness, all would be classic examples.
Or being told you've got cancer.
Exactly.
Like that.
And these are all things that primary care docs or docs are expert in dealing with, and usually responds to reassurance and education about the condition and what's going on. Only a very small number of these folks go on to develop major depression or depression that would need medication. Although psychotherapy is, of course, always important, and doctors spend a good chunk of their day giving 5-minute therapy sessions to patients, and they do it even without thinking. It's so much a part of what they do. Another type of depression is what's called dysthymic disorder, and these are people who chronically are depressed. Originally, or at least when I was in medical school in 1940, it was thought that people with dysthymic disorder were people who just chose it. Some people, you know, do different things, and these people just choose depression as a way of life. And while there are people with personality disorder where the problem is them, there's now growing evidence that people with chronic depression may well have major depression that simply didn't get better. Most people with major depression get better, but not everybody. And so some people with major depression continue to smolder along in chronic depression, and this is what's called dysthymic disorder. And we think that occurs in about 2% of the U.S. population. So not unheard of. And so many of the folks that family docs see who just, there where the glass is always 3/4 empty, that these folks may have chronic depression, which may be effectively treated with antidepressants as well as psychotherapy as well.
Now, you give statistics frequently about the American population, which leads me to ask how America compares to other industrialized countries.
Right, and we think actually that it's very similar, that studies throughout the world, for example, show similar rates of depression. Studies throughout the world in all types of culture show that women are more likely to get depressed at a ratio of about 2-1 compared to men. There is some data to suggest that undeveloped countries may have lower rates of major psychiatric disease, including major depression, and that's something that is being debated. In other words, countries where the extended family remains intact may have lower rates. But in any event, for industrialized nations, depression is about as common and occurs about as commonly in women. So it's not only our society, but unfortunately all societies where that seems to be the case, that women are more likely to get depressed. Men, by the way, I'm not saying the psychiatric disorder in total occurs more commonly in women, because we know, for example, that substance abuse occurs more commonly in men, again, by the same ratio of 2-1. And some people wonder whether depression in women really is substance abuse in men, but that's a whole other issue, of course.
Well, to talk about less developed countries and the incidence of psychiatric problems there, it seems to me, is awfully complex, and it's very hard, I would think, to get accurate data. First of all, nobody is going out and interviewing these people. Right. Secondly, there are so many other reasons why their incidence might be different. I mean, it's, yes, the extended family, they have much more support. They also may have much less exposure to industrial pollutants. There are just too many factors, but that's why I channeled my question specifically to other developed countries.
And the only thing that has really popped up, and people are looking for toxins. For example, is there a toxin that causes depression or Alzheimer's disease, for that matter?
Or autism.
Or autism, which clearly is increasing throughout the world and seems to be increasing as countries become more developed or more economically progressed, if I can use that word, or more economically complex, maybe is a better word. And all those things seem to be true. In depression, the only thing that has popped up is that diets that seem to be lower in omega-3 fatty acids, as in fish oils, seem to have higher rates of depression. And adding fish oil or adding omega-3 fatty acids to your diet seems to be helpful. And that's the only health food supplement that seems to be helpful for the treatment of depression. So if physicians are wondering what at the health food store they can recommend to patients that may be helpful for depression, omega-3 fatty acids seems to be the only thing so far that is found to be effective. St. John's Wort is not effective. SAMe is very iffy. But omega-3 fatty acids seem to be helpful.
Now, what about vitamin D? Because we had a lot of discussion in our last issue about vitamin D and depression, and in fact, the incidence of depression as it relates to latitude and presumably to sun exposure.
Right, and Peggy Knepps had a wonderful article in the last issue about that. And boy, you know, I think that's again another place where the data is not as good. And actually, I have an interest in that since I worked in Alaska, as you noted, for a couple of years. The story is that if you are born at a period of increased light, you're more likely to commit suicide than if you're not, if you're an Alaska native. And the reason for that is not clear. Is it simply that the statistics are not as clear since they're smaller populations? And so smaller numbers give a statistically significant difference. That's not clear. Is it that it is truly is sunlight and that there is some type of critical exposure or critical time, and that's not clear? Is it that at times of increased light are times when the population of your family and village are out doing other things and there's less people there and less nurturing available for you? And that also isn't clear. So in any event, it's another one of those situations where, you know, a fact will bring up 10 questions, which bring up 10 more questions.
Well, you didn't go down the other logical path, which is to say that if you're born at a time of increased light, then something is set in infancy that habituates you to being in a light environment. And then whenever you're exposed to the period of the year when there is no light, this is inconsistent with the way you were initially conditioned.
And more likely to get depressed at times of decreased light.
Right.
And what the converse argument is that it's not really being born at a time of increased light. It's during the second trimester when the brain is forming. If your mother is exposed to decreased light, that's a risk. So there's always the mirror image whenever there's seasonal arguments.
You have to look
which
at
season are you talking about? So those are the things that are debated. But in any event, it's a complex thing, and clearly we don't have good enough answers to all of these wonderful questions.
Well, Paul, we've talked a lot now about depression, but we haven't really said very much about treatment, although we did talk about the biochemical hypotheses now that underlie the depression as a clinical entity. Treatment of depression has really just taken on a totally new dimension in the last few decades because of the drugs that have become available. So rather than my trying to prompt you, let me just ask you to tell us what we should know about it.
Right. I think the first line treatment for major depression would be the SSRIs, that is drugs like fluoxetine.
And now let's just define SSRI.
Okay, right. SSRIs are specific serotonin reuptake inhibitors. That is that they focus primarily on serotonin, not serotonin and norepinephrine. And the reason for that is simply that they're cheaper. That is that they've been out for a while, they're now out in generic forms, and that means that they are more widely available. At Walmart, you can get a month's worth of fluoxetine for $4. And other pharmacies have followed suit, and I think they're $5 at other places.
Now, since most of us know brand names, what are the most commonly recognized SSRIs?
Right, so fluoxetine would be Prozac, or what was Prozac. The second most common drug that was in use was Zoloft or sertraline, which is coming out in generic form this year. Citalopram or Celexa is out in generic. Lexapro or escitalopram is out. Wellbutrin is not an SSRI, or bupropion, and that's a medication which affects a number of different neurotransmitter systems, including dopamine, and we think is helpful in smoking cessation. And then there are pills that affect both norepinephrine and serotonin, and those are venlafaxine or Effexor, as well as Cymbalta or duloxetine, which is the newer one. So there are many more, of course, in addition to that. Does it make any difference which one you choose first? And the answer is no, doesn't matter. So which should you use? And what psychiatrists do is they really base it on side effects. That if it doesn't matter to anybody, we usually use fluoxetine or generic fluoxetine first because it's cheapest. However, the problem with that is that about half of the folks can get sexual dysfunction of any kind, meaning either decreased interest in sex or problems either in erection in men or lubrication in women and problems in achieving orgasm. And so that can be a problem. And so people who say, look, I don't care what you give me as long as it doesn't affect my sex life, bupropion is the drug which is least likely to do that.
And so that's Wellbutrin.
That's Wellbutrin. So we would try that in that case. Among elders, for example, who may be ill, a common medication that's used is Remeron or mirtazapine, and Remeron is often used because it is helpful for sedation and also helpful for weight gain. And for those people who maybe are having trouble maintaining their weight because of either cancer or chronic illness, that's a wonderful pill for them, but not very popular among middle-aged women for that reason as well. So all the medications work.
Excuse me, does it stimulate the appetite or what?
It does. We think that it stimulates the appetite. The thinking is probably does it centrally, but it does. But about 20% of the people get weight gain with that. Mm-hmm. So in other words, all the medications work equally well, and they're selected either by cost or side effects. And so how do we narrow this down to somebody who says, look, I got enough to worry about? And my advice would be to know how to use generic fluoxetine or Prozac because it's the cheapest. If somebody doesn't want that, then know how to use Wellbutrin or bupropion because they should know how to use that in smoking cessation as well. And if they know those two, that's good. You give them one. If they don't want one, give them the other one. And if they don't get better, they can either use a third or refer on. How many people get better on any of these medications? And the answer is depends on what you mean by better. We think that the latest trial shows that a quarter to a third of the people will get absolutely well, back to their baseline, good as ever, on the first medication. And that's good in that there's that number of people. What's bad is that, unfortunately, boy, some people get some better, probably another third get some better, but not all the way better. And then you got a fiddle, and fiddle means either switch or add on. Most people, if they're getting no response at 8 to 12 weeks, would just switch to another pill. If they're half better, you don't want to give up that half because you don't know what you're getting next. So if they're half better, most people would add on another medication. And which one? Whichever one you want is basically the answer. And so there's not good enough answers to that. Now, what do psychiatrists do when they get sent to us? We do the same thing. We add on. We may pay more attention to side effects, what kinds of things they don't want to do, what kinds of things they think have worked best for them in the past, and so on. And the best treatment for depression is actually electroconvulsive therapy, or ECT, where about 85% of the people will get all the way better. And so that's always available and something to think about. The older medications, that is drugs like Elavil or nortriptyline or Pamelor, are still available, thankfully. And people think that they may work a bit better than the newer ones. But the problem is that they have more side effects. Dry mouth, constipation, weight gain, urinary retention are all common problems. But the most worrisome problem is that they're much, much more dangerous in overdose than are the newer agents. And so people usually use the newer ones first because of that, but the older ones may even work a little bit better and they're still available.
Now, when you say dangerous in overdose, because of psychiatric reactions or because of side effects?
Primarily of side effects, so that's a very good question. Primarily of side effects, meaning that the older agents, the tricyclic antidepressants, are more likely to cause arrhythmia, specifically PR elongation, and will lower blood pressure and so and increase heart rate because of the anticholinergic effect. So that's just a bad combination. So an overdose, the tricyclics can be fatal, unfortunately, even with a 2 or 3 week supply.
So what about lithium? That's another older drug that we didn't mention.
Right, and lithium for bipolar disorder continues to be the hallmark drug that's used. Depakote can be helpful. Lamictal or lamotrigine can be helpful for depression, as well as lots of the other anticonvulsants.
Do we know why lithium works?
That's, again, a very good question, and we don't have a very good answer. The theory is that it contributes to membrane stability, that the ion, adding that ion to the mix, but that's the theory.
You mentioned in passing ECT, electroconvulsive therapy. Why does that work?
That's, again, a very good question, and that's been available since actually the 1930s, and we don't have a good enough answer. The idea is that what happens in ECT is you use electricity to cause a seizure. The seizure causes stimulation in the brain, and then things reset. And the idea is that the repeated resetting of the brain resets the limbic system back to the where it was. And that's the idea about how it works.
How many shocks do you have to usually give?
Right, on average, 6. So on average, somebody gets 6 treatments. They're given 3 times a week. So what the story is that on average, after 2 weeks, people are back to their old selves with ECT. So something should be considered.
Now, that doesn't prevent future episodes.
Exactly. It's the best thing we have for getting somebody better now, but doesn't do anything for the future, good or bad, as far as we
can tell. And they just get a very brief general anesthetic?
Right.
I guess propofol makes something like that much easier.
Right. Propofol is generally what's used. People are unconscious. The electricity is given. The electricity lasts for 1 to 4 seconds. People seize for about 25 seconds. And then what happens is they wake up with the anesthesia, and unfortunately they're both postictal as well as confused from the anesthesia. So people are foggy generally for about an hour or two following that, and then it can be done as an outpatient these days.
Yeah.
Another treatment which continues to be effective is psychotherapy. If you look at major depression, that is a depression with physical symptoms, and look at good psychotherapy compared to medication treatment, the response rate is equal among those depressions that are not severe. I mean, obviously, to work in psychotherapy, you have to be able to concentrate, work through things, keep your appointments, cognitively be intact, And so for non-severe major depression, psychotherapy is as effective. And I think most people would think the best treatment is actually a combination of psychotherapy and medication.
Yeah, but there's also the question of time and cost. And people complain about the fact that psychiatrists don't have time for psychotherapy.
Exactly. I think that first of all, cost, as we talked about before, fluoxetine for a month costs $4. A month of psychotherapy would cost an individual, even with good insurance, with a $15 copay, 4 times 15, $60. In addition to time, it's a problem. And you also mentioned that psychiatrists, unfortunately, because of the pressure of business and managed care, often see just people for medication checks. And what's true is that these days, a psychiatrist's practice is not a whole lot different than a family doc's practice, who see people with chronic illnesses every 15 minutes, and that's what psychiatrists do as well. That psychiatrists who do psychotherapy usually do it in private practice.
Well, when you say in private practice, as opposed to the academic world, or what do you
mean?
As
opposed to the academic world, or opposed to, say, when folks are hired by organizations like Lancaster General or Philhaven or Wellspan or Hershey or wherever, the pressure of business means that you see people, and psychiatrists generally will see folks for evaluations and medication checks. And psychotherapy usually is done by people with psychologists or social workers, because outcome studies show that psychologists and social workers do as good a job, and of course they come cheaper. So that's the reason why managed care companies like that better.
So I see, when you said private practice, you meant in contradistinction to someone who is under contract,
right,
such as with a managed care company. But then in private practice, they would presumably be providing the therapy to people who could pay a fee. So what kind of insurance coverage does psychiatric illness usually get?
Less is the answer, which is a problem, of course, because these are diseases that kill people. These are diseases that cause incredible amounts of morbidity. These are diseases that contribute to all sorts of problems in families, and even economically, it's estimated that the indirect cost for depression alone to the U.S. economy is $20 billion a year from lost work time and lost productivity. But unfortunately, virtually all insurances cover psychiatric disorders less well, and I'm including federal insurance like Medicare, less well. And what that means is that, unfortunately, somebody's copay may be higher, and also that because it doesn't pay as well, that hospitals are looking at this and often do away with it. For example, Hershey, where I was, they did away with the geriatric program, decreased psychiatry. Lancaster General, in my opinion, who thankfully has more of an interest in looking out for the community, is growing the psychiatry program, and I think they should be commended for that, for no reason other than it's important to take care of the community. But the answer to your question is that the problem is that it doesn't pay as well. And I think the reason for that is both stigma, that is, there continues to be a stigma about psychiatric disorder, and also that people with psychiatric disorders, because of the stigma, don't clamor for equal coverage or more coverage, whereas people do clamor for covering their pap smears or their mammograms, for example, under coverage.
No advocacy group. And of course, if you're depressed, you don't have the energy or the will to clamor anyway.
Well, that's part of it. That's correct, that the support groups that are more active are, of course, those with bipolar disorder, where those folks, of course, have at least periods of more energy and at least periods of doing better. So I think that's very true.
Well, before we leave the subject of treatment, I think we should cover the question of how long people should be treated.
Right. With medication, if it's your first episode ever, someone should be on medication probably for 9 months to a year. That means about 6 months after they're totally better. Now, unfortunately, people, once they're totally better, will stop taking the medication, but it's important to continue to advise them to take it. The reason is that if they don't continue, the depression is more likely just to come back. If somebody has a recurrent depression, which unfortunately is true for most of the folks with depression.
Meaning that they're in their second episode,
second
or more.
Third, certainly. I think everybody would agree if it's your third episode of depression, we don't have to debate if it's coming back. It came back and came back again. So for those folks, lifelong treatment is recommended. The second one we can debate, although most of those folks probably should be on lifelong treatment.
Well, how many people will have only one episode of depression?
The longest follow-up study that I'm aware of is a 17-year follow-up of people, and in that group, 85% of the people had follow-up depressions. So it's thought that if you can follow them for long enough, virtually everybody. The only thing that we know is a few months ago, a paper came out that showed that those who had been on SSRIs or drugs like Prozac or fluoxetine or Zoloft chronically were more likely to have osteoporosis over time than people who were not, and it was dose-related, by the way. So that's the only thing that's popped up with the long-term use of these medications.
Well, I wonder how you would really divide osteoporosis out, considering that you've said depression's more common in women, it's more common in the elderly. So you really have a body of data that is corrupted by all kinds of comorbidities.
But best we can tell, it is more. And I think the reason why that's important is, first of all, that's the only thing that has popped up in the decades of use of these medications, so they're very safe. And second of all, to continue to encourage women to be cognizant of bone health and to continue to pay attention to that.
Okay. Well, I'd like to circle back to the fact that we were talking earlier about the poor insurance coverage and payment for psychiatric treatment, particularly psychotherapy and its time-consuming aspect. What impact has this had on the appeal of psychiatry as a profession? I mean, are the residencies struggling for applicants?
They are, although actually residencies have always struggled for applications. That is, that psychiatry has always been a buyer's market if you're a medical student. Best we can tell, there was a dip in people going to psychiatry, which has returned of late. But in general, in the neighborhood of 4% or 5% of medical school classes in this country go into psychiatry, which is, of course, not enough. And that number dipped, but has been reasonably stable. What the problem is, unfortunately, financially, is psychiatrists are linked with general internists and general pediatricians and family docs, although they do a little bit better than family docs, in that medical students now who are emerging from medical school with well over $100,000 in debt on average often look to more better-paying specialties to pursue their careers. So there is some impact, but psychiatry has not been impacted as much as other specialties like family medicine, for example.
I would think also it depends to some extent on the strength of psychiatric teaching at the medical school level. I know when I went to medical school, and now we're going way back, our school had an extremely strong psychiatry teaching program. It was emphasized well, and 10% of my class went into psychiatry.
Right, that would be very high.
Yeah.
So I don't think there's any question that it's important and important for medical schools to continue to look out for the community needs of people, to continue to look at psychiatry and mental health as being certainly an important part of the treatment of individuals and their families, and important to advocate for that as time goes on, even though payment may not be as good. And in the meantime, we just need to educate the insurance companies a bit better.
Okay, well, the one aspect of psychiatry that we haven't yet dealt with, and that is really important because it's the one with the most finality, is suicide. What is the incidence of suicide? You mentioned earlier some numbers, but that was a while back. I'd ask you to repeat that. And how do you know that it's becoming a real threat and that intervention is necessary?
Right, those are all good questions. We think when we look at numbers of people who kill themselves in this country, about 1.5% of Americans kill themselves, which is an astonishing number. Depending on the year, it's the 8th or 9th leading cause of death in this country. So it's unfortunately very common. We know that it occurs in virtually everybody's practice, because how can it not? If you treat 70 people, one of them's going to kill themselves on average. And so everybody sees this. And of course, the question is, can you predict it? Do you know who's going to kill themselves? And the answer is, unfortunately, you cannot. That you cannot predict the future, unfortunately. And so we don't know who will kill themselves. We can tell who's at higher risk. The people who are at higher risk are those people who have major psychiatric disorder, for example, depression or bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, that those people are more likely to kill themselves. We know that if you are going through a time of stress, that is important. We know if you're hopeless, we know that's important. And we know that if you have attempted to hurt yourself, that's very important in terms of predicting. But unfortunately, psychiatrists or anybody can't predict the future. And so we don't know who's going to kill themselves. And so first of all, is there any way to predict it? And the answer is unfortunately no. What most people do is, first of all, ask about suicide. No one has ever, when asked about it, gone on to commit suicide because they were simply asked. It's not a new idea. Everybody's had the thought. So the first thing to do is to ask about suicide. Have you thought about committing suicide, or have you felt so bad you thought life wasn't going on? When people say, yes, they've had the thought, the next question is, do you intend to do it? Or have you taken steps to carry that out? Now, most people will say no to that, but some people will say yes. If somebody intends to hurt themselves or have taken steps to carry it out, or if they say, you know, I just don't know what I'll do, that often is a time when you then have the person go to the emergency room, which is a place where somebody's always available for intervention and care. If you feel that the person is not safe enough to go to the emergency room, or if the family members are calling you, let's say you're on call, and the family members are calling you and say, in my living room, he's suicidal, I don't know what to do. Fortunately, there are social workers with guns who will help you out, and the social workers with guns are called police, and they are available 24 hours a day, and they're, of course, the people who we call for other family emergencies as well, and they will go anywhere, and they will respond quickly, that is to your office or to any family member's house, and will be able to take the person safely to an emergency room. So I would urge you to make use of that. Crisis intervention services are also available. However, because of the number, they are not as available as police. Once somebody gets in the hospital, of course, we treat and evaluate people. But unfortunately, because we can't predict, some of these folks go on to kill themselves anyhow. And this is something that is really the worry of every practitioner, every psychiatrist, every family doc, to be able to identify those people. And the bottom line is that you simply can't do it. If you get that funny feeling in your gut, I would say listen to it, that you see lots of people in practice, and when that individual touches off something in your clinical sixth sense, I would pay attention to that and refer that person for extra care as well, or emergency care to the emergency room or getting the police to help.
Well, this has been an amazingly comprehensive discussion, and I really am indebted to you. I think our audience is indebted to you. And before we wind it all up, is there anything that you would like to emphasize in the discussion?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, that depression really is quite treatable. For psychiatrists, it's our infectious disease. You just got to find the right pill. And so that is helpful. In addition, it involves really lifestyle changes, just as cardiac rehab would, that people need to look at their lives and perhaps examine it and run it a bit differently, and psychotherapy can be helpful for that, just like cardiac rehab can be helpful in lifestyle changes in people with cardiac disease. And finally, I would say that I've been at Lancaster General for about a year and a half, and I would have to say that I am impressed with the institution's commitment to the community and how important they feel serving the community is. And I can tell you from experience that is not there every place.
Well, thank you again.